Side 1, The Autobiography of Malcolm X, with the assistance of Alex Haley. Introduction by M. S. Handler. Epilogue by Alex Haley. Copyright 1964 by Alex Haley and Malcolm X. Copyright 1965 by Alex Haley and Betty Shabazz. Introduction copyright 1965 by M. S. Handler. Narrated by Earl Hyman. This book contains 460 pages on 13 sides. This book I dedicate to my beloved wife, Betty, and to our children, whose understanding and whose sacrifices made it possible for me to do my work. Contents. Introduction, Side 1. Chapter 1, Nightmare, Side 1. Chapter 2, Mascot, Side 1. Chapter 3, Homeboy, Side 2. Chapter 4, Laura, Side 2. Chapter 5, Harlemite, Side 3. Chapter 6, Detroit Red, Side 3. Chapter 7, Hustler, Side 3. Chapter 8, Trapped, Side 4. Chapter 9, Caught, Side 4. Chapter 10, Satan, Side 4. Chapter 11, Saved, Side 5. Chapter 12, Savior, Side 6. Chapter 13, Minister Malcolm X, Side 6. Chapter 14, Black Muslims, Side 7. Chapter 15, Icarus, Side 8. Chapter 16, Out, Side 8. Chapter 17, Mecca, Side 9. Chapter 18, El Hajj Malik, El Shabazz, Side 10. Chapter 19, 1965, Side 10. Alex Haley, Epilogue, Side 11. Ossie Davis, On Malcolm X, Side 13. M. S. Handler, Introduction. The Sunday before he was to officially announce his rupture with Elijah Muhammad, Malcolm X came to my home to discuss his plans and give me some necessary documentation. Mrs. Handler had never met Malcolm before this fateful visit. She served us coffee and cakes while Malcolm spoke in the courteous, gentle manner that was his in private. It was obvious to me that Mrs. Handler was impressed by Malcolm. His personality filled our living room. Malcolm's attitude was that of a man who had reached a crossroads in his life and was making a choice under an inner compulsion. A wistful smile illuminated his countenance from time to time, a smile that said many things. I felt uneasy because Malcolm was evidently trying to say something which his pride and dignity prevented him from expressing. I sensed that Malcolm was not confident he would succeed in escaping from the shadowy world which had held him in thrall. Mrs. Handler was quiet and thoughtful after Malcolm's departure. Looking up suddenly, she said, "You know, it was like having tea with a black panther." The description startled me. The black panther is an aristocrat in the animal kingdom. He is beautiful. He is dangerous. As a man, Malcolm X had the physical bearing and the inner self-confidence of a born aristocrat, and he was potentially dangerous. No man in our time aroused fear and hatred in the white man as did Malcolm, because in him the white man sensed an implacable foe who could not be had for any price, a man unreservedly committed to the cause of liberating the black man in American society rather than integrating the black man into that society. My first meeting with Malcolm X took place in March 1963 in the Muslim restaurant of Temple No. 7 on Lenox Avenue. I'd been assigned by the New York Times to investigate the growing pressures within the Negro community. 30 years of experience as a reporter in Western and Eastern Europe had taught me that the forces in a developing social struggle are frequently buried beneath the visible surface and make themselves felt in many ways long before they burst out into the open. These generative forces make themselves felt through the power of an idea long before their organizational forms can openly challenge the establishment. It is the merit of European political scientists and sociologists to give a high priority to the power of ideas in a social struggle. In the United States, it is our weakness to confuse the numerical strength of an organization and the publicity attached to leaders with the germinating forces that sow the seeds of social upheaval in our community. In studying the growing pressures within the Negro community, I had not only to seek the opinions of the established leaders of the civil rights organizations, but the opinions of those working in the penumbra of the movement, underground, so to speak. This is why I sought out Malcolm X, whose ideas had reached me through the medium of Negro integrationists. Their thinking was already reflecting a high degree of nascent Negro nationalism. I did not know what to expect as I waited for Malcolm. I was the only white person in the restaurant, an immaculate establishment tended by somber, handsome, uncommunicative Negroes. Signs reading, "Smoking Forbidden," were pasted on the highly polished mirrors. I was served coffee, but became uneasy in this aseptic, silent atmosphere as time passed. Malcolm finally arrived. He was very tall, handsome, of impressive bearing. His skin had a bronze hue. I rose to greet him and extended my hand. Malcolm's hand came up slowly. I had the impression it was difficult for him to take my hand, but noblesse oblige, he did. Malcolm then did a curious thing which he always repeated whenever we met in public in a restaurant in New York or Washington. He asked whether I would mind if he took a seat facing the door. I'd had similar requests put to me in Eastern European capitals. Malcolm was on the alert. He wished to see every person who entered the restaurant. I quickly realized that Malcolm constantly walked in danger. We spoke for more than 3 hours at this first encounter. His views about the white man were devastating, but at no time did he transgress against my own personality and make me feel that I, as an individual, shared in the guilt. He attributed the degradation of the Negro people to the white man. He denounced integration as a fraud. He contended that if the leaders of the established civil rights organizations persisted, the social struggle would end in bloodshed because he was certain the white man would never concede full integration. He argued the Muslim case for separation as the only solution in which the Negro could achieve his own identity, develop his own culture, and lay the foundations for a self-respecting, productive community. He was vague about where the Negro state could be established. Malcolm refused to see the impossibility of the white man conceding secession from the United States. At this stage in his career, he contended it was the only solution. He defended Islam as a religion that did not recognize color bars. He denounced Christianity as a religion designed for slaves, and the Negro clergy as the curse of the black man, exploiting him for their own purposes instead of seeking to liberate him and acting as handmaidens of the white community in its determination to keep the Negroes in a subservient position. During this first encounter, Malcolm also sought to enlighten me about the Negro mentality. He repeatedly cautioned me to beware of Negro affirmations of goodwill toward the white man. He said that the Negro had been trained to dissemble and conceal his real thoughts as a matter of survival. He argued that the Negro only tells the white man what he believes the white man wishes to hear, and that the art of dissembling reached a point where even Negroes cannot truthfully say they understand what their fellow Negroes believe. The art of deception practiced by the Negro was based on a thorough understanding of the white man's mores, he said. At the same time, the Negro has remained a closed book to the white man, who has never displayed any interest in understanding the Negro. Malcolm's exposition of his social ideas was clear and thoughtful, if somewhat shocking to the white initiate. But most disconcerting in our talk was Malcolm's belief in Elijah Muhammad's history of the origins of man and in a genetic theory devised to prove the superiority of black over white, a theory stunning to me in its sheer absurdity. After this first encounter, I realized that there were two Malcolms, the private and the public person. His public performances on television and at meeting halls produced an almost terrifying effect. His implacable marshalling of facts and his logic had something of a new dialectic, diabolic in its force. He frightened white television audiences, demolished his Negro opponents, but elicited a remarkable response from Negro audiences. Many Negro opponents in the end refused to make any public appearances on the same platform with him. The troubled white audiences were confused, disturbed, felt themselves threatened, Some began to consider Malcolm evil incarnate. Malcolm appealed to the two most disparate elements in the Negro community, the depressed mass and the galaxy of Negro writers and artists who burst on the American scene in the past decade. The Negro middle class, the Negro establishment, abhorred and feared Malcolm as much as he despised it. The impoverished Negroes respected Malcolm in the way that wayward children respect the grandfather image. It was always a strange and moving experience to walk with Malcolm in Harlem. He was known to all. People glanced at him shyly. Sometimes Negro youngsters would ask for his autograph. It always seemed to me that their affection for Malcolm was inspired by the fact that although he had become a national figure, he was still a man of the people who they felt would never betray them. The Negroes have suffered too long from betrayals, and in Malcolm they sensed a man of mission. They knew his origins, with which they could identify. They knew his criminal and prison record, which he had never concealed. They looked upon Malcolm with a certain wonderment. Here was a man who had come from the lower depths which they still inhabited, who had triumphed over his own criminality and his own ignorance to become a forceful leader and spokesman, an uncompromising champion of his people. Although many could not share his Muslim religious beliefs, they found in Malcolm's Puritanism a standing reproach to their own lives. Malcolm had purged himself of all the ills that afflict the depressed Negro mass: drugs, alcohol, tobacco, not to speak of criminal pursuits. His personal life was impeccable, of a Puritanism unattainable for the mass. Human redemption. Malcolm had achieved it in his own lifetime, and this was known to the Negro community. In his television appearances and at public meetings, Malcolm articulated the woes and the aspirations of the depressed Negro mass in a way it was unable to do for itself. When he attacked the white man, Malcolm did for the Negroes what they couldn't do for themselves. He attacked with a violence and anger that spoke for the ages of misery. It was not an academic exercise of just giving hell to Mr. Charlie. Many of the Negro writers and artists who are national figures today revered Malcolm for what they considered his ruthless honesty in stating the Negro case, his refusal to compromise, and his search for a group identity that had been destroyed by the white man when he brought the Negroes in chains from Africa. The Negro writers and artists regarded Malcolm as the great catalyst, the man who inspired self-respect and devotion in the downtrodden millions. A group of these artists gathered one Sunday in my home, and we talked about Malcolm. Their devotion to him as a man was moving. One said, "Malcolm will never betray us. We have suffered too much from betrayals in the past." Malcolm's attitude toward the white man underwent a marked change in 1964, a change that contributed to his break with Elijah Muhammad and his racist doctrines. Malcolm's meteoric eruption on the national scene brought him into wider contact with white men who were not the devils he had thought they were. He was much in demand as a speaker at student forums in Eastern universities, and had appeared at many by the end of his short career as a national figure. He always spoke respectfully and with a certain surprise of the positive response of white students to his lectures. A second factor that contributed to his conversion to wider horizons was a growing doubt about the authenticity of Elijah Muhammad's version of the Muslim religion, a doubt that grew into a certainty with more knowledge and more experience. Certain secular practices at the Chicago headquarters of Elijah Muhammad had come to Malcolm's notice, and he was profoundly shocked. Finally, he embarked on a number of prolonged trips to Mecca and the newly independent African states through the good offices of the representatives of the Arab League in the United States. It was on his first trip to Mecca that he came to the conclusion that he had yet to discover Islam. Assassin's bullets ended Malcolm's career before he was able to develop this new approach, which in essence recognized the Negroes as an integral part of the American community, a far cry from Elijah Muhammad's doctrine of separation. Malcolm had reached the midpoint in redefining his attitude to this country and the white-black relationship. He no longer inveighed against the United States, but against a segment of the United States represented by overt white supremacists in the South and covert white supremacists in the North. It was Malcolm's intention to raise Negro militancy to a new high point, with the main thrust aimed at both the Southern and Northern white supremacists. The Negro problem, which he had always said should be renamed the white man's problem, was beginning to assume new dimensions for him in the last months of his life. To the very end, Malcolm sought to refashion the broken strands between the American Negroes and African culture. He saw in this the road to a new sense of group identity, a self-conscious role in history, and above all, a sense of man's own worth which he claimed the white man had destroyed in the Negro. American autobiographical literature is filled with numerous accounts of remarkable men who pull themselves to the summit by their bootstraps. Few are as poignant as Malcolm's memoirs. As testimony to the power of redemption and the force of human personality, the autobiography of Malcolm X is a revelation. New York, June 1965. The autobiography of Malcolm X. Chapter 1, Nightmare. When my mother was pregnant with me, she told me later, a party of hooded Ku Klux Klan riders galloped up to our home in Omaha, Nebraska one night. Surrounding the house, brandishing their shotguns and rifles, they shouted for my father to come out. My mother went to the front door and opened it. Standing where they could see her pregnant condition, she told them that she was alone with her three small children and that my father was away preaching in Milwaukee. The Klansmen shouted threats and warnings at her that we better get out of town because the good Christian white people were not going to stand for my father's spreading trouble among the good Negroes of Omaha with the back to Africa preachings of Marcus Garvey. My father, the Reverend Earl Little, was a Baptist minister, a dedicated organizer for Marcus Aurelius Garvey's UNIA, Universal Negro Improvement Association. With the help of such disciples as my father, Garvey, from his headquarters in New York City's Harlem, was raising the banner of black race purity and exhorting the Negro masses to return to their ancestral African homeland, a cause which had made Garvey the most controversial black man on earth. Still shouting threats, the Klansmen finally spurred their horses and galloped around the house, shattering every window pane with their gun butts. Then they rode off into the night, their torches flaring, as suddenly as they had come. My father was enraged when he returned. He decided to wait until I was born, which would be soon, and then the family would move. I'm not sure why he made this decision, for he was not a frightened Negro, as most then were, and many still are today. My father was a big 6'4", very black man. He had only one eye. How he'd lost the other one, I've never known. He was from Reynolds, Georgia, where he'd left school after the third or maybe fourth grade. He believed, as did Marcus Garvey, that freedom, independence, and self-respect could never be achieved by the Negro in America, and that therefore the Negro should leave America to the white man and return to his African land of origin. Among the reasons my father decided to risk and dedicate his life to help disseminate this philosophy among his people was that he had seen four of his six brothers die by violence, three of them killed by white men, including one by lynching. What my father could not know then was that of the remaining three, including himself, only one, my Uncle Jim, would die in bed of natural causes. Northern white police were later to shoot my Uncle Oscar, and my father was finally himself to die by the white man's hands. It has always been my belief that I, too, will die by violence. I have done all that I can to be prepared. I was my father's seventh child. He had three children by a previous marriage, Ella, Earl, and Mary, who lived in Boston. He had met and married my mother in Philadelphia, where their first child, my oldest full brother, Wilfred, was born. They moved from Philadelphia to Omaha, where Hilda and then Philbert were born. I was next in line. My mother was 28 when I was born on May 19th, 1925, in an Omaha hospital. Then we moved to Milwaukee, where Reginald was born. From infancy, he had some kind of hernia condition which was to handicap him physically for the rest of his life. Louise Little, my mother, who was born in Grenada in the British West Indies, looked like a white woman. Her father was white. She had straight black hair, and her accent did not sound like a Negro's. Of this white father of hers, I know nothing except her shame about it. I remember hearing her say she was glad that she'd never seen him. It was, of course, because of him that I got my reddish-brown, meriny color of skin and my hair of the same color. I was the lightest child in our family. Out in the world later on, in Boston and New York, I was among the millions of Negroes who were insane enough to feel that it was some kind of status symbol to be light-complexioned, that one was actually fortunate to be born thus. But still later, I learned to hate every drop of that white rapist's blood that is in me. Our family stayed only briefly in Milwaukee, for my father wanted to find a place where he could raise our own food and perhaps build a business. The teaching of Marcus Garvey stressed becoming independent of the white man. We went next, for some reason, to Lansing, Michigan. My father bought a house, and soon, as had been his pattern, he was doing freelance Christian preaching in local Negro Baptist churches, and during the week he was roaming about spreading word of Marcus Garvey. He'd begun to lay away savings for the store he'd always wanted to own when, as always, some stupid local Uncle Tom Negroes began to funnel stories about his revolutionary beliefs to the local white people. This time, the get-out-of-town threats came from a local hate society called the Black Legion. They wore black robes instead of white. Soon, nearly everywhere my father went, black legionnaires were reviling him as an uppity nigger for wanting to own a store, for living outside the Lansing Negro District, for spreading unrest and dissension among the good niggers. As in Omaha, my mother was pregnant again, this time with my youngest sister. Shortly after Yvonne was born came the nightmare night in 1929, my earliest vivid memory. I remember being suddenly snatched awake into a frightening confusion of pistol shots and shouting and smoke and flames. My father had shouted and shot at the two white men who had set the fire and were running away. Our home was burning down around us. We were lunging and bumping and tumbling all over each other, trying to escape. My mother, with a baby in her arms, just made it into the yard before the house crashed in, showering sparks. I remember we were outside in the night in our underwear, crying and yelling our heads off. The white police and firemen came and stood around watching as the house burned down to the ground. My father prevailed on some friends to clothe and house us temporarily. Then he moved us into another house in the outskirts of East Lansing. In those days, Negroes weren't allowed after dark in East Lansing proper. There's where Michigan State University is located. I related all of this to an audience of students when I spoke there in January 1963, and had the first reunion in a long while with my younger brother, Robert, who was there doing postgraduate studies in psychology. I told them how East Lansing harassed us so much that we had to move again, this time 2 miles out of town into the country. This was where my father built for us with his own hands a four-room house. This is where I really begin to remember things. This home where I started to grow up. After the fire, I remember that my father was called in and questioned about a permit for the pistol with which he had shot at the white men who set the fire. I remember that the police were always dropping by our house, shoving things around, just checking, or looking for a gun. The pistol they were looking for, which they never found, and for which they wouldn't issue a permit, was sewed up inside a pillow. My father's .22 rifle and his shotgun, though, were right out in the open. Everyone had them for hunting birds and rabbits and other game. After that, my memories are of the friction between my father and mother. They seemed to be nearly always at odds. Sometimes my father would beat her. It might have had something to do with the fact that my mother had a pretty good education. Where she got it, I don't know. But an educated woman, I suppose, can't resist the temptation to correct an uneducated man. Every now and then, when she put those smooth words on him, he would grab her. My father was also belligerent toward all of the children, except me. The older ones he would beat almost savagely if they broke any of his rules, and he had so many rules it was hard to know them all. Nearly all my whippings came from my mother. I've thought a lot about why. I actually believe that as anti-white as my father was, he was subconsciously so afflicted with the white man's brainwashing of Negroes that he inclined to favor the light ones, and I was his lightest child. Most Negro parents in those days would almost instinctively treat any lighter children better than they did the darker ones. It came directly from the slavery tradition that the mulatto, because he was visibly nearer to white, was therefore better. My two other images of my father are both outside the home. One was his role as a Baptist preacher. He never pastored in any regular church of his own. He was always a visiting preacher. I remember especially his favorite sermon. That little black train is a-coming, and you better get all your business right. I guess this also fit his association with the Back to Africa movement, with Marcus Garvey's Black Train Homeward. My brother Filbert, the one just older than me, loved church, but it confused and amazed me. I would sit goggle-eyed at my father jumping and shouting as he preached, with the congregation jumping and shouting behind him, their souls and bodies devoted to singing and praying. Even at that young age, I just couldn't believe in the Christian concept of Jesus as someone divine, and no religious person, until I was a man in my 20s, and then in prison, could tell me anything. I had very little respect for most people who represented religion. It was in his role as a preacher that my father had most contact with the Negroes of Lansing. Believe me when I tell you that those Negroes were in bad shape then. They are still in bad shape, though in a different way. By that I mean that I don't know a town with a higher percentage of complacent and misguided so-called middle-class Negroes, the typical status symbol-oriented, integration-seeking type of Negroes. Just recently, I was standing in a lobby at the United Nations talking with an African ambassador and his wife, when a Negro came up to me and said, "You know me?" I was a little embarrassed because I thought he was someone I should remember. It turned out that he was one of those bragging, self-satisfied, middle-class Lansing Negroes. I wasn't ingratiated. He was the type who would never have been associated with Africa until the fad of having African friends became a status symbol for middle-class Negroes. Back when I was growing up, the successful Lansing Negroes were such as waiters and bootblacks. To be a janitor at some downtown store was to be highly respected. The real elite, the big shots, the voices of the race, were the waiters at the Lansing Country Club and the shoeshine boys at the state capitol. The only Negroes who really had any money were the ones in the numbers racket, or who ran the gambling houses, or who in some other way lived parasitically off the poorest ones, who were the masses. No Negroes were hired then by Lansing's big Oldsmobile plant, or the Rio plant. Do you remember the Rio? It was manufactured in Lansing, and R.E. Olds, the man after whom it was named, also lived in Lansing. When the war came along, they hired some Negro janitors. The bulk of the Negroes were either on welfare, or WPA, or they starved. The day was to come when our family was so poor that we would eat the whole out of a donut. But at that time, we were much better off than most town Negroes. The reason was we raised much of our own food out there in the country where we were. We were much better off than the town Negroes who would shout, because my father preached, for the pie in the sky and their heaven in the hereafter, while the white man had his here on earth. I knew that the collections my father got for his preaching were mainly what fed and clothed us. And he also did other odd jobs. But still, the image of him that made me proudest was his crusading and militant campaigning with the words of Marcus Garvey. As young as I was then, I knew from what I overheard that my father was saying something that made him a tough man. I remember an old lady grinning and saying to my father, "You're scaring these white folks to death." One of the reasons I've always felt that my father favored me was that, to the best of my remembrance, it was only me that he sometimes took with him to the Garvey UNIA meetings, which he held quietly in different people's homes. There were never more than a few people at any one time, 20 at most. But that was a lot, packed into someone's living room. I noticed how differently they all acted, although sometimes they were the same people who jumped and shouted in church. But in these meetings, both they and my father were more intense, more intelligent, and down to earth. It made me feel the same way. I can remember hearing of Adam driven out of the garden into the caves of Europe, Africa for the Africans, Ethiopians awake, and my father would talk about how it would not be much longer before Africa would be completely run by Negroes. By black men, was the phrase he always used. No one knows when the hour of Africa's redemption cometh. It is in the wind, It is coming. One day, like a storm, it will be here. I remember seeing the big, shiny photographs of Marcus Garvey that were passed from hand to hand. My father had a big envelope of them that he always took to these meetings. The picture showed what seemed to me millions of Negroes thronged in parade behind Garvey riding in a fine car, a big black man dressed in a dazzling uniform with gold braid on it, and he was wearing a thrilling hat with tall plumes. I remember hearing that he had black followers not only in the United States, but all around the world. And I remember how the meetings always closed with my father saying, several times, and the people chanting after him, "Up, you mighty race. You can accomplish what you will." I've never understood why, after hearing as much as I did of these kinds of things, I somehow never thought then of the black people in Africa. My image of Africa at that time was of naked savages, cannibals, monkeys, and tigers in steaming jungles. My father would drive in his old black touring car, sometimes taking me, to meeting places all around the Lansing area. I remember one daytime meeting, most were at night, in the town of Owosso, 40 miles from Lansing, which the Negroes called White City. Owosso's greatest claim to fame is that it is the hometown of Thomas E. Dewey. As in East Lansing, no Negroes were allowed on the streets there after dark, hence the daytime meeting. In point of fact, in those days, lots of Michigan towns were like that. Every town had a few home Negroes who lived there. Sometimes it would be just one family, as in the nearby county seat, Mason, which had a single Negro family named Lyons. Mr. Lyons had been a famous football star at Mason High School, was highly thought of in Mason, and consequently he now worked around that town in menial jobs. My mother this time seemed to be always working, cooking, washing, ironing, cleaning, and fussing over us 8 children, and she was usually either arguing with or not speaking to my father. One cause of friction was that she had strong ideas about what she wouldn't eat and didn't want us to eat, including pork and rabbit, both of which my father loved dearly. He was a real Georgia Negro, and he believed in eating plenty of what we in Harlem today call soul food. I've said that my mother was the one who whipped me. At least she did whenever she wasn't ashamed to let the neighbors think she was killing me. For if she even acted as though she was about to raise her hand to me, I would open my mouth and let the world know about it. If anybody was passing by out on the road, she would either change her mind or just give me a few licks. Thinking about it now, I feel definitely that just as my father favored me for being lighter than the other children, my mother gave me more hell for the same reason. She was very light herself, but she favored the ones who were darker. Wilfred, I know, was particularly her angel. I remember that she would tell me to get out of the house and let the sun shine on you so you can get some color. She went out of her way never to let me become afflicted with a sense of color superiority. I'm sure that she treated me this way partly because of how she came to be light herself. I learned early that crying out in protest could accomplish things. My older brothers and sister had started to school when sometimes they would come in and ask for a buttered biscuit or something, and my mother impatiently would tell them no. But I would cry out and make a fuss until I got what I wanted. I remember well how my mother asked me why I couldn't be a nice boy like Wilfred, but I would think to myself that Wilfred, for being so nice and quiet, often stayed hungry. So early in life, I'd learned that if you want something, you'd better make some noise. Not only did we have our big garden, but we raised chickens. My father would buy some baby chicks, and my mother would raise them. We all loved chicken. That was one dish there was no argument with my father about. One thing in particular that I remember made me feel grateful toward my mother was that one day I went and asked her for my own garden, and she did let me have my own little plot. I loved it and took care of it well. I loved especially to grow peas. I was proud when we had them on our table. I would pull out the grass in my garden by hand when the first little blades came up. I would patrol the rows on my hands and knees for any worms and bugs, and I would kill and bury them. And sometimes when I had everything straight and clean for my things to grow, I would lie down on my back between two rows, and I would gaze up in the blue sky at the clouds moving and think all kinds of things. At 5, I too began to go to school, leaving home in the morning along with Wilfred, Hilda, and Filbert. It was the Pleasant Grove School that went from kindergarten through the eighth grade. It was 2 miles outside the city limits, and I guess there was no problem about our attending because we were the only Negroes in the area. In those days, white people in the North usually would adopt just a few Negroes. They didn't see them as any threat. The white kids didn't make any great thing about us either. They called us nigger and darky and rascals so much that we thought those were our natural names. But they didn't think of it as an insult. It was just the way they thought about us. One afternoon in 1931, when Wilfred, Hilda, Philbert, and I came home, my mother and father were having one of their arguments. There'd lately been a lot of tension around the house because of Black Legion threats. Anyway, my father had taken one of the rabbits which we were raising and ordered my mother to cook it. We raised rabbits, but sold them to whites. My father had taken a rabbit from the rabbit pen. He had pulled off the rabbit's head. He was so strong he needed no knife to behead chickens or rabbits. With one twist of his big black hands, he simply twisted off the head and threw the bleeding-necked thing back at my mother's feet. My mother was crying. She started to skin the rabbit, preparatory to cooking it. But my father was so angry, he slammed on out the front door and started walking up the road toward town. It was then that my mother had this vision. She had always been a strange woman in this sense, and had always had a strong intuition of things about to happen. And most of her children are the same way, I think. When something is about to happen, I can feel something, sense something. I never have known something to happen that has caught me completely off guard, except once. And that was when, years later, I discovered facts I couldn't believe about a man who, up until that discovery, I would gladly have given my life for. My father was well up the road when my mother ran screaming out onto the porch, "Early! Early!" She screamed his name. She clutched up her apron in one hand and ran down across the yard and into the road. My father turned around. He saw her. For some reason, considering how angry he had been when he left, he waved at her. But he kept on going. She told me later, my mother did, that she had a vision of my father's end. All the rest of the afternoon, she was not herself, crying and nervous and upset. She finished cooking the rabbit and put the whole thing in the warmer part of the black stove. When my father was not back home by our bedtime, my mother hugged and clutched us, and we felt strange, not knowing what to do, because she'd never acted like that. I remember waking up to the sound of my mother screaming again. When I scrambled out, I saw the police in the living room. They were trying to calm her down. She had snatched on her clothes to go with them. And all of us children who were staring knew without anyone having to say it that something terrible had happened to our father. My mother was taken by the police to the hospital and to a room where a sheet was over my father in a bed, and she wouldn't look. She was afraid to look. Probably it was wise that she didn't. My father's skull on one side was crushed in, I was told later. Negroes in Lansing have always whispered that he was attacked and then laid across some tracks for a streetcar to run over him. His body was cut almost in half. He lived 2.5 hours in that condition. Negroes then were stronger than they are now, especially Georgia Negroes. Negroes born in Georgia had to be strong, simply to survive. It was morning when we children at home got the word that he was dead. I was 6. I can remember a vague commotion, the house filled up with people crying, saying bitterly that the white Black Legion had finally gotten him. My mother was hysterical. In the bedroom, women were holding smelling salts under her nose. She was still hysterical at the funeral. I don't have a very clear memory of the funeral either. Oddly, the main thing I remember is that it wasn't in a church, and that surprised me, since my father was a preacher, and I'd been where he preached people's funerals in churches. But his was in a funeral home. And I remember that during the service, a big black fly came down and landed on my father's face. And Wilfred sprang up from his chair and he shooed the fly away, and he came groping back to his chair. There were folding chairs for us to sit on, and the tears were streaming down his face. When we went by the casket, I remember that I thought that it looked as if my father's strong black face had been dusted with flour, and I wished they hadn't put on such a lot of it. Back in the big four-room house, there were many visitors for another week or so. There were good friends of the family, such as the Lyons from Mason, 12 miles away, and the Walkers, McGuires, Liscoes, the Greens, Randolphs, and the Turners, and others from Lansing, and a lot of people from other towns whom I had seen at the Garvey meetings. We children adjusted more easily than our mother did. We couldn't see as clearly as she did the trials that lay ahead. As the visitors tapered off, she became very concerned about collecting the two insurance policies that my father had always been proud he carried. It always said that families should be protected in case of death. One policy apparently paid off without any problem. The smaller one. I don't know the amount of it. I would imagine it was not more than $1,000, and maybe half of that. But after that money came, and my mother had paid out a lot of it for the funeral and expenses, she began going into town and returning very upset. The company that had issued the bigger policy was balking at paying off. They were claiming that my father had committed suicide. Visitors came again, and there was bitter talk about white people. How could my father bash himself in the head, then get down across the streetcar tracks to be run over? So there we were. My mother was 34 years old now, with no husband, no provider or protector to take care of her 8 children. But some kind of a family routine got going again. And for as long as the first insurance money lasted, we did all right. Wilfred, who was a pretty stable fellow, began to act older than his age. I think he had the sense to see when the rest of us didn't what was in the wind for us. He quietly quit school and went to town in search of work. He took any kind of job he could find, and he would come home dog-tired in the evenings and give whatever he had made to my mother. Hilda always had been quiet, too, attended to the babies. Philbert and I didn't contribute anything. We just fought all the time, each other at home, and then at school we would team up and fight white kids. Sometimes the fights would be racial in nature, but they might be about anything. Reginald came under my wing. Since he'd grown out of the toddling stage, he and I had become very close. I suppose I enjoyed the fact that he was the little one, under me, who looked up to me. My mother began to buy on credit. My father had always been very strongly against credit. Credit is the first step into debt and back into slavery, he'd always said. And then she went to work herself. She would go into Lansing and find different jobs, in housework or sewing, for white people. They didn't realize, usually, that she was a Negro. A lot of white people around there didn't want Negroes in their houses. She would do fine until in some way or other it got to people who she was, whose widow she was. And then she would be let go. I remember how she used to come home crying, but trying to hide it, because she'd lost a job that she needed so much. Once when one of us, I cannot remember which, had to go for something to where she was working, and the people saw us and realized she was actually a Negro, she was fired on the spot, and she came home crying, this time not hiding it. When the state welfare people began coming to our house, we would come from school sometimes and find them talking with our mother, asking 1,000 questions. They acted and looked at her and at us and around in our house in a way that had about it the feeling, at least for me, that we were not people. In their eyesight, we were just things. That was all. My mother began to receive 2 checks, a welfare check and, I believe, a widow's pension. The checks helped, but they weren't enough, as many of us as there were. When they came, about the first of the month, one always was already owed in full, if not more, to the man at the grocery store, and after that the other one didn't last long. We began to go swiftly downhill. The physical downhill wasn't as quick as the psychological. My mother was, above everything else, a proud woman, and it took its toll on her that she was accepting charity, and her feelings were communicated to us. She would speak sharply to the man at the grocery store for padding the bill, telling him that she wasn't ignorant, and he didn't like that. She would talk back sharply to the state welfare people, telling them that she was a grown woman, able to raise her children, that it wasn't necessary for them to keep coming around so much, meddling in our lives. And they didn't like that. But the monthly welfare check was their pass. They acted as if they owned us, as if we were their private property. As much as my mother would have liked to, she couldn't keep them out. She would get particularly incensed when they began insisting upon drawing us older children aside, one at a time, out on the porch or somewhere, and asking us questions or telling us things, against our mother and against each other. We couldn't understand why, if the state was willing to give us packages of meat, sacks of potatoes and fruit, and cans of all kinds of things, our mother obviously hated to accept. We really couldn't understand. What I later understood was that my mother was making a desperate effort to preserve her pride. And ours. Pride was just about all we had to preserve. For by 1934, we really began to suffer. This was about the worst Depression year. And no one we knew had enough to eat or live on. Some old family friends visited us now and then. At first, they brought food. Though it was charity, my mother took it. Wilfred was working to help. My mother was working, when she could find any kind of job. In Lansing, there was a bakery where, for a nickel, a couple of us children would buy a tall flour sack of day-old bread and cookies, and then walk the 2 miles back out into the country to our house. Our mother knew, I guess, dozens of ways to cook things with bread and out of bread. Stewed tomatoes with bread. Maybe that would be a meal. Something like French toast, if we had any eggs. Bread pudding, sometimes with raisins in it. If we got hold of some hamburger, it came to the table more bread than meat. The cookies that were always in the sack with the bread, we just gobbled down straight. But there were times when there wasn't even a nickel, and we would be so hungry, we were dizzy. My mother would boil a big pot of dandelion greens, and we would eat that. I remember that some small-minded neighbor put it out, and children would tease us, that we ate fried grass. Sometimes, if we were lucky, we would have oatmeal or cornmeal mush 3 times a day, or mush in the morning and cornbread at night. Philbert and I were grown up enough to quit fighting long enough to take the .22 caliber rifle that had been our father's and shoot rabbits that some white neighbors up or down the road would buy. I know now that they just did it to help us, because they, like everyone, shot their own rabbits. Sometimes I remember Philbert and I would take little Reginald along with us. He wasn't very strong, but he was always so proud to be along. We would trap muskrats out in the little creek in back of our house, and we would lie quiet until unsuspecting bullfrogs appeared, and we would spear them, cut off their legs, and sell them for a nickel a pair to people who lived up and down the road. The whites seemed less restricted in their dietary tastes. Then about in late 1934, I would guess, something began to happen. Some kind of psychological deterioration hit our family circle and began to eat away our pride. Perhaps it was the constant tangible evidence that we were destitute. We had known other families who'd gone on relief. We had known, without anyone in our home ever expressing it, that we'd felt prouder not to be at the depot where the free food was passed out. And now, we were among them. At school, the on relief finger suddenly was pointed at us, too. And sometimes it was said aloud. It seemed that everything to eat in our house was stamped not to be sold. All welfare food bore this stamp to keep the recipients from selling it. It's a wonder we didn't come to think of not to be sold as a brand name. Sometimes, instead of going home from school, I walked the 2 miles up the road into Lansing. I began drifting from store to store, hanging around outside where things like apples were displayed in boxes and barrels and baskets. And I would watch my chance and steal me a treat. You know what a treat was to me? Anything. Well, I began to drop in about dinner time at the home of some family that we knew. I knew that they knew exactly why I was there, but they never embarrassed me by letting on. They would invite me to stay for supper, and I would stuff myself. Especially I liked to drop in and visit at the Gohanna's home. They were nice, older people and great churchgoers. I'd watch them lead the jumping and shouting when my father preached. They had, living with them, they were raising him, a nephew whom everyone called Big Boy, and he and I got along fine. Also living with the Gohannas was old Mrs. Adcock, who went with them to church. She was always trying to help anybody she could, visiting anyone she heard was sick, carrying them something. She was the one who, years later, would tell me something that I remembered a long time. Malcolm, there's one thing I like about you. You're no good, but you don't try to hide it. You are not a hypocrite. The more I began to stay away from home and visit people and steal from the stores, the more aggressive I became in my inclinations. I never wanted to wait for anything. I was growing up fast, physically more so than mentally. As I began to be recognized more around the town, I started to become aware of the peculiar attitude of white people toward me. I sensed that it had to do with my father. It was an adult version of what several white children had said at school, in hints, or sometimes in the open, which really expressed what their parents had said, that the Black Legion or the Klan had killed my father, and the insurance company pulled a fast one in refusing to pay my mother the policy money. When I began to get caught stealing now and then, the state welfare people began to focus on me when they came to our house. I can't remember how I first became aware that they were talking of taking me away. What I first remember along that line was my mother raising a storm about being able to bring up her own children. She would whip me for stealing, and I would try to alarm the neighborhood with my yelling. One thing I've always been proud of is that I never raised my hand against my mother. In the summertime at night, in addition to all the other things we did, some of us boys would slip out down the road or across the pastures and go cooning watermelons. White people always associated watermelons with Negroes, and they sometimes called Negroes coons, among all the other names, and so stealing watermelons became cooning them. If white boys were doing it, it implied that they were only acting like Negroes. Whites have always hidden or justified all of the guilts they could by ridiculing or blaming Negroes. One Halloween night, I remember that a bunch of us were out tipping over those old country outhouses. And one old farmer, I guess he had tipped over enough in his day, had set a trap for us. Always, you sneak up from behind the outhouse, then you gang together and push it to tip it over. This farmer had taken his outhouse off the hole and set it just in front of the hole. Well, we came sneaking up in single file in the darkness, and the two white boys in the lead fell down into the outhouse hole neck deep. They smelled so bad it was all we could stand to get them out, and that finished us all for that Halloween. I just missed falling in myself. The whites were so used to taking the lead, this time it had really gotten them in the hole. Thus, in various ways, I learned various things. I picked strawberries, and though I can't recall what I got per crate for picking, I remember that after working hard all one day, I wound up with about a dollar, which was a whole lot of money in those times. I was so hungry, I didn't know what to do. I was walking away toward town with visions of buying something good to eat, and this older white boy I knew, Richard Dixon, came up and asked me if I wanted to match nickels. He had plenty of change for my dollar. In about a half hour, he had all the change back, including my dollar, and instead of going to town to buy something, I went home with nothing, and I was bitter. But that was nothing compared to what I felt when I found out later that he had cheated. There's a way that you can catch and hold the nickel and make it come up the way you want. This was my first lesson about gambling. If you see somebody winning all the time, he isn't gambling. He's cheating. Later on in life, if I were continuously losing in any gambling situation, I would watch very closely. It's like the Negro in America seeing the white man win all the time. He's a professional gambler. He has all the cards and the odds stacked on his side, and he has always dealt to our people from the bottom of the deck. About this time, my mother began to be visited by some Seventh-day Adventists who had moved into a house not too far down the road from us. They would talk to her for hours at a time and leave booklets and leaflets and magazines for her to read. She read them, and Wilfred, who had started back to school after we'd begun to get the relief food supplies, also read a lot. His head was forever in some book. Before long, my mother spent much time with the Adventists. It's my belief that what mostly influenced her was that they had even more diet restrictions than she always had taught and practiced with us. Like us, they were against eating rabbit and pork. They followed the Mosaic dietary laws. They ate nothing of the flesh without a split hoof or that didn't chew a cud. We began to go with my mother to the Adventist meetings that were held further out in the country. For us children, I know that the major attraction was the good food they served. But we listened, too. There were a handful of Negroes from small towns in the area, but I would say that it was 99% white people. The Adventists felt that we were living at the end of time, that the world soon was coming to an end. But they were the friendliest white people I had ever seen. In some ways, though, we children noticed, and when we were back at home, discussed that they were different from us, such as the lack of enough seasoning in their food and the different way that white people smelled. Meanwhile, the state welfare people kept after my mother. By now, she didn't make it any secret that she hated them and didn't want them in her house. But they exerted their right to come, and I have many, many times reflected upon how, talking to us children, they began to plant the seeds of division in our minds. They would ask such things as who was smarter than the other, and they would ask me why I was so different. I think they felt that getting children into foster homes was a legitimate part of their function, and the result would be less troublesome, however they went about it. And when my mother fought them, they went after her. First, through me. I was the first target. I stole. That implied that I wasn't being taken care of by my mother. All of us were mischievous at some time or another, I more so than any of the rest. Philbert and I kept a battle going, and this was just one of a dozen things that kept building up the pressure on my mother. I'm not sure just how or when the idea was first dropped by the welfare workers that our mother was losing her mind, but I can distinctly remember hearing crazy applied to her by them when they learned that the Negro farmer who was in the next house down the road from us had offered to give us some butchered pork, a whole pig, maybe even two of them, and she had refused. We all heard them call my mother crazy to her face for refusing good meat. It meant nothing to them even when she explained that we'd never eaten pork, that it was against her religion as a Seventh-day Adventist. They were as vicious as vultures. They had no feelings, understanding, compassion, or respect for my mother. They told us she's crazy for refusing food. Right then was when our home, our unity, began to disintegrate. We were having a hard time, and I wasn't helping. But we could have made it. We could have stayed together. As bad as I was, as much trouble and worry as I caused my mother, I loved her. The state people, we found out, had interviewed the Gohannis family, and the Gohannis had said they would take me into their home. My mother threw a fit, though, when she heard that, and the home wreckers took cover for a while. It was about this time that the large, dark man from Lansing began visiting. I don't remember how or where he and my mother met. It may have been through some mutual friends. I don't remember what the man's profession was. In 1935, in Lansing, Negroes didn't have anything you could call a profession. But the man, big and black, looked something like my father. I can remember his name, but there's no need to mention it. He was a single man, and my mother was a widow, only 36 years old. The man was independent. Naturally, she admired that. She was having a hard time disciplining us, and a big man's presence alone would help. And if she had a man to provide, it would send the state people away forever. We all understood without ever saying much about it, or at least we had no objection. We took it in stride, even with some amusement among us, that when the man came, our mother would be all dressed up in the best that she had. She still was a good-looking woman, and she would act differently, light-hearted and laughing, as we hadn't seen her act in years. It went on for about a year, I guess, and then about 1936 or 1937, the man from Lansing jilted my mother suddenly. He just stopped coming to see her. From what I later understood, he finally backed away from taking on the responsibility of those 8 mouths to feed. He was afraid of so many of us. To this day, I can see the trap that Mother was in, saddled with all of us, and I can also understand why he would shun taking on such a tremendous responsibility. But it was a terrible shock to her. It was the beginning of the end of reality for my mother. When she began to sit around and walk around talking to herself, almost as though she was unaware that we were there, it became increasingly terrifying. The state people saw her weakening. That was when they began the definite steps to take me away from home. They began to tell me how nice it was going to be at the Gohannis home, where the Gohannis and Big Boy and Mrs. Adcock had all said how much they liked me and would like to have me live with them. I liked all of them, too, but I didn't want to leave Wilfred. I looked up to and admired my big brother. I didn't want to leave Hilda, who was like my second mother, or Philbert. Even in our fighting, there was a feeling of brotherly union. Or Reginald, especially, who was weak with his hernia condition, and who looked up to me as his big brother who looked out for him, as I looked up to Wilfred. And I had nothing either against the babies, Yvonne, Wesley, and Robert. As my mother talked to herself more and more, she gradually became less responsive to us, and less responsible. The house became less tidy. We began to be more unkempt. And usually now, Hilda cooked. We children watched our anchor giving way. It was something terrible that you couldn't get your hands on, yet you couldn't get away from. It was a sensing that something bad was going to happen. We younger ones leaned more and more heavily on the relative strength of Wilfred and Hilda, who were the oldest. When finally I was sent to the Gohannis home, at least in a surface way, I was glad. I remember that when I left home with the state man, my mother said one thing. Don't let them feed him any pig. It was better in a lot of ways at the Grahanas. Big Boy and I shared his room together, and we hit it off nicely. He just wasn't the same as my blood brothers. The Grahanas were very religious people. Big Boy and I attended church with them. They were sanctified holy rollers now. The preachers and congregations jumped even higher and shouted even louder than the Baptists I had known. They sang at the top of their lungs and swayed back and forth and cried and moaned and beat on tambourines and chanted. It was spooky, with ghosts and spirituals and hats seeming to be in the very atmosphere when finally we all came out of the church, going back home. The Grahanas and Mrs. Atcock loved to go fishing, and some Saturdays Big Boy and I would go along. I had changed schools now to Lansing's West Junior High School. It was right in the heart of the Negro community, and a few white kids were there, but Big Boy didn't mix much with any of our schoolmates, and I didn't either. And when we went fishing, neither he nor I liked the idea of just sitting and waiting for the fish to jerk the cork under the water or make the tight line quiver when we fished that way. I figured there should be some smarter way to get the fish, though we never discovered what it might be. Mr. Grahanas was close cronies with some other men who, some Saturdays, would take me and Big Boy with them hunting rabbits. I had my father's .22 caliber rifle. My mother had said it was all right for me to take it with me. The old men had a set rabbit-hunting strategy that they had always used. Usually when a dog jumps a rabbit and the rabbit gets away, that rabbit will always somehow instinctively run in a circle and return sooner or later past the very spot where he originally was jumped. Well, the old men would just sit and wait in hiding somewhere for the rabbit to come back, then get their shots at him. I got to thinking about it, and finally I thought of a plan. I would separate from them, and Big Boy and I would go to a point where I figured that the rabbit, returning, would have to pass me first. It worked like magic. I began to get three and four rabbits before they got one. The astonishing thing was that none of the old men ever figured out why. They outdid themselves, exclaiming what a sure shot I was. I was about 12 then. All I had done was to improve on their strategy. And it was the beginning of a very important lesson in life. That any time you find someone more successful than you are, especially when you're both engaged in the same business, you know they're doing something that you aren't. I would return home to visit fairly often. Sometimes Big Boy and one or another, or both, of the Grahanas would go with me, sometimes not. I would be glad when some of them did go because it made the ordeal easier. Soon the state people were making plans to take over all of my mother's children. She talked to herself nearly all of the time now, and there was a crowd of new white people entering the picture, always asking questions. They would even visit me at the Grahanas. They would ask me questions out on the porch or sitting out in their cars. Eventually, my mother suffered a complete breakdown, and the court orders were finally signed. They took her to the state mental hospital at Kalamazoo. It was 70-some miles from Lansing, about an hour and a half on the bus. A Judge McClellan in Lansing had authority over me and all of my brothers and sisters. We were state children, court wards. He had the full say-so over us. A white man in charge of a black man's children. Nothing but legal, modern slavery, however kindly intentioned. My mother remained in the same hospital at Kalamazoo for about 26 years. Later, when I was still growing up in Michigan, I would go to visit her every so often. Nothing that I can imagine could have moved me as deeply as seeing her pitiful state. In 1963, we got my mother out of the hospital, and she now lives there in Lansing with Philbert and his family. It was so much worse than if it had been a physical sickness for which a cause might be known, medicine given, a cure effected. Every time I visited her, when finally they led her, a case, a number, back inside from where we'd been sitting together, I felt worse. My last visit, when I knew I would never come to see her again, there, was in 1952. I was 27. My brother Philbert had told me that on his last visit, she had recognized him somewhat. In spots, he said. But she didn't recognize me at all. She stared at me. She didn't know who I was. Her mind, when I tried to talk, to reach her, was somewhere else. I asked, "Mama, do you know what day it is?" She said, staring, "All the people have gone." I can't describe how I felt. The woman who had brought me into the world and nursed me and advised me and chastised me and loved me didn't know me. It was as if I was trying to walk up the side of a hill of feathers. I looked at her. I listened to her talk. But there was nothing I could do. I truly believe that if ever a state social agency destroyed a family, it destroyed ours. We wanted and tried to stay together. Our home didn't have to be destroyed. But the welfare, the courts, and their doctor gave us the 1-2-3 punch. And ours was not the only case of this kind. I knew I wouldn't be back to see my mother again because it could make me a very vicious and dangerous person. Knowing how they had looked at us as numbers and as a case in their book, not as human beings. And knowing that my mother in there was a statistic that didn't have to be, that existed because of a society's failure, hypocrisy, greed, and lack of mercy and compassion. Hence, I have no mercy or compassion in me for a society that will crush people and then penalize them for not being able to stand up under the weight. I rarely talk to anyone about my mother, for I believe that I'm capable of killing a person without hesitation who happened to make the wrong kind of remark about my mother. So I purposely don't make any opening for some fool to step into. Back then, when our family was destroyed in 1937, Wilfred and Hilda were old enough so that the state let them stay on their own in the big four-room house that my father had built. Philbert was placed with another family in Lansing, a Mrs. Hackett, while Reginald and Wesley went to live with a family called Williams, who were friends of my mother's. And Yvonne and Robert went to live with a West Indian family named McGuire. Separated though we were, all of us maintained fairly close touch around Lansing, in school and out, whenever we could get together. Despite the artificially created separation and distance between us, we still remained very close in our feelings toward each other. Chapter 2. Mascot. On June 27th of that year, 1937, Joe Louis knocked out James J. Braddock to become the heavyweight champion of the world. And all the Negroes in Lansing, like Negroes everywhere, went wildly happy with the greatest celebration of race pride our generation had ever known. Every Negro boy old enough to walk wanted to be the next Brown Bomber. My brother Philbert, who had already become a pretty good boxer in school, was no exception. I was trying to play basketball. I was gangling and tall, but I wasn't very good at it. Too awkward. In the fall of that year, Philbert entered the amateur bouts that were held in Lansing's Pruden Auditorium. He did well, surviving the increasingly tough eliminations. I would go down to the gym and watch him train. It was very exciting. Perhaps without realizing it, I became secretly envious. For one thing, I know I could not help seeing some of my younger brother Reginald's lifelong admiration for me getting siphoned off to Philbert. People praised Philbert as a natural boxer. I figured that since we belonged to the same family, maybe I would become one too. So I put myself in the ring. I think I was 13 when I signed up for my first bout, but my height and raw-boned frame let me get away with claiming that I was 16, the minimum age, and my weight of about 128 pounds got me classified as a bantamweight. They matched me with a white boy, a novice like myself, named Bill Peterson. I'll never forget him. When our turn in the next amateur bouts came up, all of my brothers and sisters were there watching, along with just about everyone else I knew in town. They were there not so much because of me, but because of Philbert, who had begun to build up a pretty good following, and they wanted to see how his brother would do. I walked down the aisle between the people thronging the rows of seats and climbed in the ring. Bill Peterson and I were introduced, and then the referee called us together and mumbled all of that stuff about fighting fair and breaking clean. Then the bell rang, and we came out of our corners. I knew I was scared. But I didn't know, as Bill Peterson told me later on, that he was scared of me, too. He was so scared I was going to hurt him that he knocked me down 50 times if he did once. He did such a job on my reputation in the Negro neighborhood that I practically went into hiding. A Negro just can't be whipped by somebody white and returned with his head up to the neighborhood, especially in those days when sports and, to a lesser extent, show business were the only fields open to Negroes, and when the ring was the only place a Negro could whip a white man and not be lynched. When I did show my face again, The Negroes I knew rode me so badly, I knew I had to do something. But the worst of my humiliations was my younger brother Reginald's attitude. He simply never mentioned the fight. It was the way he looked at me and avoided looking at me. So I went back to the gym, and I trained hard. I beat bags and skipped rope and grunted and sweated all over the place. And finally, I signed up to fight Bill Peterson again. This time, the bouts were held in his hometown of Alma, Michigan. The only thing better about the rematch was that hardly anyone I knew was there to see it. I was particularly grateful for Reginald's absence. The moment the bell rang, I saw a fist, then the canvas coming up, and 10 seconds later, the referee was saying 10 over me. It was probably the shortest fight in history. I lay there listening to the full count, but I couldn't move. To tell the truth, I'm not sure I wanted to move. That white boy was the beginning and the end of my fight career. A lot of times in these later years since I became a Muslim, I thought back to that fight and reflected that it was Allah's work to stop me. I might have wound up punching. Not long after this, I came into a classroom with my hat on. I did it deliberately. The teacher, who was white, ordered me to keep the hat on and to walk around and around the room until he told me to stop. That way, he said, everyone can see you. Meanwhile, we go on with class for those who are here to learn something. I was still walking around when he got up from his desk and turned to the blackboard to write something on it. Everyone in the classroom was looking when, at this moment, I passed behind his desk, snatched up a thumbtack, and deposited it in his chair. When he turned to sit back down, I was far from the scene of the crime, circling around the rear of the room. Then he hit the tack, and I heard him holler and caught a glimpse of him spraddling up as I disappeared through the door. With my deportment record, I wasn't really shocked when the decision came that I'd been expelled. I guess I must have had some vague idea that if I didn't have to go to school, I'd be allowed to stay on with the Gohanas and wander around town, or maybe get a job if I wanted one for pocket money. But I got rocked on my heels when a state man whom I hadn't seen before came and got me at the Gohanas and took me down to court. They told me I was going to go to a reform school. I was still 13 years old. But first I was going to the detention home. It was in Mason, Michigan, about 12 miles from Lansing. The detention home was where all the bad boys and girls from Ingham County were held on their way to reform school, waiting for their hearings. The white state man was a Mr. Maynard Allen. He was nicer to me than most of the state welfare people had been. He even had consoling words for the Gohanas and Mrs. Adcock and Big Boy. All of them were crying. But I wasn't. With the few clothes I owned stuffed into a box, we rode in his car to Mason. He talked as he drove along, saying that my school marks showed that if I would just straighten up, I could make something of myself. He said the reform school had the wrong reputation. He talked about what the word reform meant, to change and become better. He said the school was really a place where boys like me could have time to see their mistakes and start a new life and become somebody everyone would be proud of. And he told me that the lady in charge of the detention home, a Mrs. Swirlin, and her husband were very good people. They were good people. Mrs. Swirlin was bigger than her husband, I remember, a big, buxom, robust, laughing woman. And Mr. Swirlin was thin, with black hair and a black mustache and a red face, quiet and polite, even to me. They liked me right away, too. Mrs. Swirlin showed me to my room, my own room. The first in my life. It was in one of those huge dormitory-like buildings where kids in detention were kept in those days, and still are in most places. I discovered next, with surprise, that I was allowed to eat with the Swirlins. It was the first time I'd eaten with white people, at least with grown white people, since the Seventh-day Adventist country meetings. It wasn't my own exclusive privilege, of course, except for the very troublesome boys and girls at the detention home who were kept locked up, those who'd run away and been caught and brought back or something like that. All of us ate with the Swirlins, sitting at the head of the long tables. They had a white cook helper, I recall, Lucille Lathrop. It amazes me how these names come back from a time I haven't thought about for more than 20 years. Lucille treated me well, too. Her husband's name was Duane Lathrop. He worked somewhere else, but he stayed there at the detention home on the weekends with Lucille. I noticed again how white people smelled different from us, and how their food tasted different. Not seasoned like Negro cooking. I began to sweep and mop and dust around in the Swirlin's house, as I'd done with Big Boy at the Gohannas. They all liked my attitude, and it was out of their liking for me that I soon became accepted by them. As a mascot, I know now. They would talk about anything and everything with me standing right there hearing them, the same way people would talk freely in front of a pet canary. They would even talk about me or about niggers, as though I wasn't there, as if I wouldn't understand what the word meant. 100 times a day they used the word nigger. I suppose that in their own minds they meant no harm. In fact, they probably meant well. It was the same with the cook, Lucille, and her husband, Duane. I remember one day when Mr. Swirlin, as nice as he was, came in from Lansing, where he'd been through the Negro section, and said to Mrs. Swirlin right in front of me, "I just can't see how those niggers can be so happy and be so poor." He talked about how they lived in shacks, but had those big, shining cars out front. And Mrs. Swirlin said, me standing right there, "Niggers are just that way." That scene always stayed with me. It was the same with the other white people, most of them local politicians, when they would come visiting the Swirlins. One of their favorite parlor topics was niggers. One of them was the judge who was in charge of me in Lansing. He was a close friend of the Swirlins. He would ask about me when he came, and they would call me in, and he would look me up and down, his expression approving, like he was examining a fine colt or a pedigreed pup. I knew they must have told him how I acted and how I worked. What I'm trying to say is that it just never dawned upon them that I could understand that I wasn't a pet, but a human being. They didn't give me credit for having the same sensitivity, intellect, and understanding that they would have been ready and willing to recognize in a white boy in my position. But it has historically been the case with white people, in their regard for black people, that even though we might be with them, we weren't considered of them. Even though they appeared to have opened the door, it was still closed. Thus, they never did really see me. This is the sort of kindly condescension which I try to clarify today to these integration-hungry Negroes about their liberal white friends, these so-called good white people, most of them anyway. I don't care how nice one is to you. The thing you must always remember is that almost never does he really see you as he sees himself, as he sees his own kind. He may stand with you through thin, but not thick. When the chips are down, you'll find that as fixed in him as his bone structure is his sometimes subconscious conviction that he's better than anybody black. But I was no more than vaguely aware of anything like that in my detention home years. I did my little chores around the house, and everything was fine. And each weekend, they didn't mind my catching a ride over to Lansing for the afternoon or evening. If I wasn't old enough, I sure was big enough by then. And nobody ever questioned my hanging out, even at night, in the streets of the Negro section. I was growing up to be even bigger than Wilfred and Filbert, who had begun to meet girls at the school dances and other places, and introduced me to a few. But the ones who seemed to like me, I didn't go for, and vice versa. I couldn't dance a lick anyway, and I couldn't see squandering my few dimes on girls. So mostly I pleasured myself these Saturday nights by gawking around the Negro bars and restaurants. The jukeboxes were wailing Erskine Hawkins' Tuxedo Junction, Slim and Slam's Flatfoot Fluji, things like that. Sometimes big bands from New York, out touring the one-night stands and the sticks, would play for big dances in Lansing. Everybody with legs would come out to see any performer who bore the magic name New York, which is how I first heard Lucky Thompson and Milt Jackson, both of whom I later got to know well in Harlem. Many youngsters from the detention home, when their dates came up, went off to the reform school. But when mine came up, 2 or 3 times, it was always ignored. I saw new youngsters arrive and leave. I was glad and grateful. I knew it was Mrs. Swirlin's doing. I didn't want to leave. She finally told me one day that I was going to be entered in Mason Junior High School. It was the only school in town. No ward of the detention home had ever gone to school there, at least while still a ward. So I entered their 7th grade. The only other Negroes there were some of the Lyons children, younger than I was, in the lower grades. The Lyons and I, as it happened, were the town's only Negroes. They were, as Negroes, very much respected. Mr. Lyons was a smart, hard-working man, and Mrs. Lyons was a very good woman. She and my mother, I'd heard my mother say, were 2 of the 4 West Indians in that whole section of Michigan. Some of the white kids at school, I found, were even friendlier than some of those in Lansing had been, though some, including the teachers, called me nigger. It was easy to see that they didn't mean any more harm by it than the Swirlins. As the nigger of my class, I was in fact extremely popular. I suppose partly because I was kind of a novelty. I was in demand. I had top priority. But I also benefited from the special prestige of having the seal of approval from that very important woman about the town of Mason, Mrs. Swerlin. Nobody in Mason would have dreamed of getting on the wrong side of her. It became hard for me to get through a school day without someone after me to join this or head up that. The debating society, the junior high basketball team, or some other extracurricular activity. I never turned them down. And I hadn't been in the school long when Mrs. Swerlin, knowing I could use spending money of my own, got me a job after school washing the dishes in a local restaurant. My boss there was the father of a white classmate whom I spent a lot of time with. His family lived over the restaurant. It was fine working there. Every Friday night when I got paid, I'd feel at least 10 feet tall. I forget how much I made, but it seemed like a lot. It was the first time I'd ever had any money to speak of, or my own, in my whole life. As soon as I could afford it, I bought a green suit and some shoes, and at school I'd buy treats for the others in my class, at least as much as any of them did for me. English and history were the subjects I liked most. My English teacher, I recall, a Mr. Ostrowski, was always giving advice about how to become something in life. The one thing I didn't like about history class was that the teacher, Mr. Williams, was a great one for nigger jokes. One day during my first week at school, I walked into the room and he started singing to the class as a joke. Way down yonder in the cotton field, some folks say that a nigger won't steal. Very funny. I liked history, but I never thereafter had much liking for Mr. Williams. Later, I remember, we came to the textbook section on Negro history. It was exactly one paragraph long. Mr. Williams laughed through it practically in a single breath, reading aloud how the Negroes had been slaves and then were freed, and how they were usually lazy and dumb and shiftless. He added, I remember, an anthropological footnote on his own, telling us between laughs how Negroes' feet were so big that when they walk, they don't leave tracks. They leave a hole in the ground. I'm sorry to say that the subject I most disliked was mathematics. I've thought about it. I think the reason was that mathematics leaves no room for argument. If you made a mistake, that was all there was to it. Basketball was a big thing in my life, though. I was on the team. We traveled to neighboring towns such as Howell and Charlotte. And wherever I showed my face, the audiences in the gymnasiums niggered and cooned me to death, or called me Rastus. It didn't bother my teammates or my coach at all, and to tell the truth, it bothered me only vaguely. Mine was the same psychology that makes Negroes even today, though it bothers them down inside, keep letting the white man tell them how much progress they are making. They've heard it so much they've almost gotten brainwashed into believing it, or at least accepting it. After the basketball games, there would usually be a school dance. Whenever our team walked into another school's gym for the dance, with me among them, I could feel the freeze. It would start to ease as they saw that I didn't try to mix, but stuck close to someone on our team or kept to myself. I think I developed ways to do it without making it obvious. Even at our own school, I could sense it almost as a physical barrier, that despite all the beaming and smiling, the mascot wasn't supposed to dance with any of the white girls. It was some kind of psychic message, not just from them, but also from within myself. I'm proud to be able to say that much for myself, at least. I would just stand around and smile and talk and drink punch and eat sandwiches, and then I would make some excuse and get away early. There were typical small-town school dances. Sometimes a little white band from Lansing would be brought in to play. But most often the music was a phonograph set up on a table with the volume turned up high and the records scratchy, blaring things like Glenn Miller's Moonlight Serenade, his band was riding high then, or the Ink Spots, who were also very popular, singing If I Didn't Care. I used to spend a lot of time thinking about a peculiar thing. Many of these Mason white boys, like the ones at the Lansing School, especially if they knew me well and if we hung out a lot together, would get me off in a corner somewhere and push me to proposition certain white girls, sometimes their own sisters. They would tell me that they'd already had the girls themselves, including their sisters, or that they were trying to and couldn't. Later on, I came to understand what was going on. If they could get the girls into the position of having broken the terrible taboo by slipping off with me somewhere, they would have that hammer over the girls' heads to make them give in to them. It seemed that the white boys felt that I, being a Negro, just naturally knew more about romance or sex than they did, that I instinctively knew more about what to do and say with their own girls. I never did tell anybody that I really went for some of the white girls, and some of them went for me, too. They let me know in many ways. But any time we found ourselves in any close conversations or potentially intimate situations, always there would come up between us some kind of a wall. The girls I really wanted to have were a couple of Negro girls whom Wilfred or Philbert had introduced me to in Lansing. But with these girls, somehow, I lacked the nerve. From what I heard and saw on the Saturday nights I spent hanging around in the Negro district, I knew that race mixing went on in Lansing. But strangely enough, this didn't have any kind of effect on me. Every Negro in Lansing, I guess, knew how white men would drive along certain streets in the black neighborhoods and pick up Negro streetwalkers who patrolled the area. And, on the other hand, there was a bridge that separated the Negro and Polish neighborhoods, where white women would drive or walk across and pick up Negro men who would hang around in certain places close to the bridge, waiting for them. Lansing's white women, even in those days, were famous for chasing Negro men. I didn't yet appreciate how most whites accord to the Negro this reputation for prodigious sexual prowess. There in Lansing, I never heard of any trouble about this mixing from either side. I imagine that everyone simply took it for granted, as I did. End of Side 1.